Welcome on to a Monday night, Tuesday morning, in Danny's case, edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast after the travel nightmare that afflicted all of basketball media today. Our intrepid hero, Mr. LaRue, is joining us from Cleveland. Danny, what's up?
I'm happy to be not on a plane and not in an airport.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I've actually gotten to enjoy traveling a little more lately because I got TSA Pre. That can be my recommendation for today, by the way, since we haven't done one of those in a while. TSA Pre, $75 for 5 years. You get to go in that quick line that everyone's always blowing by you in, that you're angry at them in the airport. You don't have to take your shoes off. Don't have to take your laptop out. It seriously removes like 25% of the angst of flying for me. But I also don't regularly fly through O'Hare International Airport.
One thing I'll add is that certain credit cards, including the one I have, this proves how I'm an idiot, actually cover that cost as well. And I still haven't done it.
Yeah. No, it's and especially because you can just sign up at the airport now, too, I think. So if you fly more than like twice a year, it's like totally worth it. In any event, let's move on to some basketball. I had Coach Eberhardt on last night. We got into some real deep specifics, but we didn't get a chance to do kind of our usual rundown. So since you haven't had a chance to talk about this game yet, what stood out to you? What do you want to say?
Well, there was a lot to take in, and I like the phrase that LeBron used of calling it the grit squad. But the guy who stood out to me in this game, and he didn't play really at all in the fourth quarter, is Timofey Mozgov. I thought he was fabulous when he was on the court, and he substantially outplayed Bogut and was a huge factor in them winning, even if he wasn't on the court at the end.
So everybody's been killing Bogut recently.
He wasn't that bad.
Quite a few writers I talked to have been saying that. I know Ethan's been saying that. You know, I obviously respect his opinion a lot, and hopefully he will be a podcast guest at some point. But I don't agree, and here's why. So, like, what exactly should Bogut be doing differently than what he is doing right now, in your opinion?
Well, that's a fair point. I think that the bigger issue is that Mozgov has been playing better, not that Bogut has been playing badly. I mean, to me, outplaying somebody doesn't have to be that they're underperforming. I think Mozgov has made a huge difference defensively, and is also the way that they are using him offensively is more than Bogut, but that's just because he's a little bit different and because the way their offense is structured. I don't think that's, Bogut has been bad. I just think Mozgov has been excellent.
Yeah, he has been. I mean, but they have different roles. And frankly, Bogut, ever since his elbow injury, is not someone who is going to come in and dunk on people. Like, I think the Cavs have been taking advantage of his limitations, absolutely. But I don't think he's been doing poorly for what his role is. He's been doing the same thing to me that he's been doing all year. I mean, he had 9 defensive rebounds in 25 minutes. That's pretty darn good. I don't think that they were cleaning up on the glass nearly as badly when he was in there, although that's probably something I'll check when you're talking, is to see, what the rebound rate was with him in there. But he was also key in that first quarter when they got out to a 2012 lead and kind of looked like Cleveland was just never going to score a bucket until LeBron really got going. So, and he protected the basket a lot. I mean, I think the problem is that, and the other thing he did really well too was when Thompson was hot in the second quarter, they were just running a pin down to Bogut's side, and he was getting Thompson open every single time, especially when he was guarded by Smith. So I thought all those were good things that he did. He's just not someone who is going to be able to score one-on-one, not even someone who's a great finisher on dump-offs. So I think maybe the only thing you could point to was that the dribble handoff game wasn't working with him. But the Cavs were doing an awesome job at denying that. I think that was more the perimeter players for Golden State not being able to get any separation to get the ball from Bogut. So, I think Bogut is the least of their worries. I would point the finger more, frankly, at Draymond Green than Bogut.
Oh, I think that's definitely fair, too. I just think
Did I miss anything, though, on Bogut that he should be doing better?
I don't think that the ball movement issues are really him at all. I think that what the difference, you conveyed it better, is also probably that you were around the media from post-game two and I wasn't, because I was traveling. So I didn't hear any really of that. It was more just my feeling of being there is like, wow, Mozgov was doing so much better. But yeah, Draymond, especially because his offensive role is so much more defined and so much more important, even when other things aren't going. And He hasn't been great to me. He didn't have any made field goals in game one. He had a couple of nice tip-ins in game two, especially, I think it was late in game two from what I recall. But yeah, I mean, he hasn't been that force. And he also, his three-point shooting has been a misfire through the whole playoff so far, but he still has to be able to shoot those and to make the other team believe that he's going to shoot those.
Yeah, and, you know, I think he's definitely had some ankle tweaks here and there. You know, it doesn't look to be moving quite that fluidly, although his defense was unbelievable when he was playing center in the small lineup in the fourth quarter in overtime. But, you know, I think something that I've gained a greater appreciation for the last couple of years is that when you have issues with your lower body, I think LeBron is another example. It's really the jumper is the first thing that gets bothered, because that's such a well-oiled machine that if you get a cog out of line, you're not jumping quite the way you expect, not getting the lift, or, you know, one leg is not as strong as the other or something like that. You can't stop and pop the way you want to. You can really throw your jump shot off. And I think we're seeing that with James. We're seeing it maybe with Green, although, you know, he'd probably tell you there's nothing wrong with him. You know, Ersan Ilyasova was another guy last year who just could not hit a jump shot because he had all those lower body issues. So maybe that's what's going on with some of these guys at this point who suddenly are just not able to hit from outside. Jeff Teague would be another guy, actually, you know, who had some ankle problems and wasn't able to make the shot the way he normally was in the playoffs.
Yeah, that's a good point. Something else I wanted to bring up, more of a broad scope thing that you and I both noticed, and I think we talked about it in person, is that Cleveland is doing a really nice job, particularly holding their power forward back and just slowing down Golden State's transition offense by just literally slowing the guy down, making him weave through something.
On makes, you mean?
Yes, on makes.
Regular inbounds, yeah.
Yes. And I mean, because the Warriors, you remember, I stumped for it in the Pelican series and in the Memphis series. That's something that they can do, and it has done a nice job of slowing it down. It's not a perfect thing, but it's been effective in those circumstances.
Yeah, I think the Warriors, if they wanted to, could spend a little more time. And the Cavs went away from that as time went on. I think if they get more tired in both games, but it was effective. That's the type of thing that it kind of annoys me to see, because I think if the Warriors really made just a little bit more of an effort to get open, if they brought another guy back and then, were able to push the ball down the floor after that, they might be, you know, get the ball back to the inbounder. You know, if they're going to try and deny Steph the ball and James Jones, who's guarding the four man, is on him, you get the ball in, and then if he's denying the ball further up the court, especially if it's a sideline out of bounds, just throw it right back to Green. And then all of a sudden you got Cleveland in a mismatch for the rest of the possession, because whoever Curry's man is going to have to pick up Green, since Jones or whoever the four man is will be behind the play. But, you know, I think that's probably getting a little bit too much talk because, you know, it's only on made field goals. But, yeah, I mean, I think the Cavs did do a nice job keeping the Warriors out of transition, but I would give the offensive rebounding and just their isolation and turnover avoidance more credit for that.
Sure, that's definitely fair.
So yeah, what else stood out to you last night?
Let me see. I thought that early. Well, another story from these playoffs. It happened again, was Klay Thompson getting himself in foul trouble at an inopportune moment. I mean, the way I phrased it during the game was that he commits fouls like somebody who doesn't necessarily appreciate how important he is. And that isn't to say, oh, he's dumb or anything like that. It's just that there is a mentality shift when you are a pivotal player that, you know, you can't commit fouls just because, you know, even if it's the right play just in terms of limiting a clean shot or something like that, because you getting your full minutes is that important to your team.
Yeah, that's he does have a bit of a propensity for that. But on the other hand, he's a really good defensive player, a really dogged defensive player, and you wouldn't necessarily want to curb that aggressiveness. Here's a big picture thing for you here. And this might be a little bit of contrarianism for me. and I'm not sure I believe it or not, but I do think it's worthy of discussion. Has LeBron James been as good in this series as everyone is saying he has been?
No. I mean, I think that one of the challenges that we still see in the league is that counting stats are really sexy. And his counting stats are unbelievable because he's, you know, I call it pulling a Russell Westbrook because that's the most recent example of it. You know, he's playing heavy usage. They're asking him to do a lot, and he is doing a lot. But he I'm sure there's a lot of the emotional stuff, but I try not to think about that because it's really hard to quantify it, so it's hard to give him credit for that. Like, oh, he's the reason they're playing hard or anything like that. It's the finals. They're playing hard because it's the finals. But he is shouldering a very heavy load, so he does deserve that credit, but I don't think it's... I think that talking about it is like, you know, oh, he carried them or anything. It gives real short shrift to a lot of guys on this team that did great jobs. I mean, even somebody... The guys, James Jones off the bench, I thought James Jones did a nice job of doing what they needed him to do. And he made some open shots. And I mean, I made a joke that, you know, James Jones getting his fourth foul, it was shocking that that mattered in an NBA Finals game. But those guys in game two, those guys needed to step up, and they absolutely did.
So this would be my biggest counter argument to the James has been awesome parade, really. And I understand it, where you see, all right, you know, they don't have any names around him, especially on the offensive end. They're in the NBA Finals. They're playing great. You know, who else could it be? It's got to be him. And offensively, he has been carrying everything. But let's look at the overall results of that, right? They're scoring at basically like a Sixers level rate against this Golden State defense. Admittedly, Golden State is a great defense, so don't get me wrong about that. But, I mean, they're not scoring so incredibly well as a result of his heroics. I mean, now you could say they'd be doing even worse, but it'd be tough for any NBA team really to be scoring much worse than the Cavs have over these first couple of games. On the other hand, he has helped to avoid turnovers. He only had 3 turnovers, despite that astronomical usage, with the 11 assists and... 43 shooting possessions, so that's pretty impressive. And, you know, they're playing this kind of iso ball that's slowing everything down and keeping the pace slow. You know, if they move the ball more or they were just some team with less talent, they might be turning it over, and that would be hurting their offense, you know, because all that's interrelated. But I do think that it's you want to ascribe all of the success to him because there aren't any other names on here, and you're like, oh, Timofey Mozgov is our second best player. But the overall offensive product with what he's been doing just hasn't been that good.
Yeah, I think that's definitely there. And also his defensive role on this team, people think of LeBron, you know, his luminary years in Miami when he was that huge difference maker on that end, but they're not asking him to do a ton on that end. He has had some nice plays, but it's been a team effort, and I think Mozgov and Thompson deserve the lion's share of the credit for the success they've had there.
Yeah, I mean, and I will say, you know, I mean, I think like Amon Shumpert and Dellavedova and J.R. Smith could go a combined 10 out of 34 with pretty much anyone passing on the ball, probably. Yeah, I mean, it is pretty, I will say it is pretty remarkable what LeBron is doing. He had 11 assists. The rest of the team combined had 3.
Wow.
I mean, so maybe you can't, I mean, and I'm not trying to be too contrary. I mean, he's a wonderful player. I think that he certainly, you know, I wrote in that article about the top 10 players. I thought Curry might have surpassed him, but I was worried that LeBron would prove me wrong in the playoffs. I thought that Curry had actually outplayed him in the playoffs until this series, but I think LeBron has clearly been better than him after, you know, Curry's putrid performance in that last game. But yeah, I mean, I do think that there's a very good argument that they would indeed be so much worse, you know, if they were moving the ball more, if they were, you know, had a little more even distribution of talent. But, you know, you also have to look at really the overall record and the efficiency. You know, there's a reason that we keep track of that stuff, you know, and I don't think you necessarily should just throw it totally out the window because they won the game. Their offense was horrible.
Yeah, here's one LeBron stat that's really amazing. You talked about how he had 11 assists and the rest of the team had 3. As a team, they also had 2 secondary assists and 3 what they call like free throw secondary assists. So it's like, or free throw assists. So it's, that's if, yeah, if a guy was going to free throw. 4 of those 5 were LeBron too.
Which hey, is... are you looking at the page right now? Sorry for an aside. That actually is pretty remarkable. That's a stat. What does it say for Bogut's rim protection numbers, just out of curiosity, and Mozgov, for that matter? I haven't had a chance to look at that yet.
Andrew Bogut, they were 2 for 8, which is very good. And yep. Mozgov, they were 0 for 2.
Wow, 0 for 2 is it, huh?
Yes.
You know, I think, well, what it is more than, I think, is that they've stopped challenging him because Green will get the ball, and he's basically got a 2-on-1 there, and he's not going in. He's trying to throw a couple of alley-oops to Azili and Bogut. This always kills me. Throw your alley-oop basically like one ball to the right of the basket. So, and if you do that, guess what? It's never going to go over the guy's head. He can just go right there and dunk it. Like, they always aim it for kind of like so he can catch it like on his way to the basket. And if you just put a little bit more air under it and just put it right next to the basket, it's much easier to catch. You know, there's in the like 5 alley-oops that I've ever caught in my life, like it's much easier to catch it when it's right next to the basket. Believe me, I need all the help I can get. I know. So it's that's the place to put it rather than like, you know, way out by the corner of the backboard. And Bogut in previous years was able to go get those. This year he's lost a little explosion and he's struggled with it. So I think that's one thing. I mean, if they get 3 of those plays, you know, I think that was how many alley-oops they flubbed. The strategy might change for Cleveland.
That's a great point. And you're talking about alley-oops. I need a stepladder to get one. So I'm not going to, I can't talk from experience, but one, I hadn't looked this up, but because you asked me about it. So we talked about how the Warriors were 0-2 with Mozgov. They were 11-12 on defended shots at the rim when anybody other than Mozgov was the closest defender.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. But I mean, I think they just, gave up a lot of, gave up not that many shots at the rim, basically. I mean, if they only, so that was key for the Cavs. I mean, they, you know, the Warriors couldn't hit a 3 and, you know, they weren't getting much at the rim. So that's how your offense ends up being so bad. Let's move on to Steph Curry's performance. You know, there was the famous stat that ESPN Stats and Info tweeted out of when Dele was the primary defender, Curry was 0 for 8. Rick Bucher had a nice tweet that he watched, you know, the first 4 of those shots, and Curry got good shots in all those possessions. So, you know, I think Dele did do a really nice job off the ball, and Shumpert actually guarded Curry quite a bit as well. But how much of this to you was Curry missing shots? How much is the Cavs' performance, and what do you anticipate will happen going forward now?
I think that the Cavs deserve credit for making him work for everything, but he missed a lot of looks he usually makes. And I don't think that necessarily goes to fault, as our friend Seth Partnow likes to say, it's a make-or-miss league. It totally is. I don't think there's anything mechanically wrong, though he, as you said yesterday with Doug, he was missing differently than he usually misses, which makes me think that, you know, there's something, not like, oh, there's something big going on, but that was different, and I did notice that. But I think that you were right to talk about how Dellavedova was particularly strong off the ball, and that was something that was a huge difference maker in the Rockets series, is that the Rockets, their main defenders on Curry, did a nice job on ball but were pretty bad off ball, and he exploited that. And I think that those looks he's generally very comfortable with. He was one of the best catch and shoot guys in the league when he was younger and was playing more off the ball, Monte, and even post Monte. So I think that helps. I think that, you know, that makes it better. But a lot of the looks he was getting and a couple other guys, they were clean. So you think that more of those are going to go in regardless of how well they defend him. And Cleveland can do a better job cleaning that up. But to me, there was plenty of potential for regression to the mean in a positive way for the Warriors.
I will say this, Cleveland's defense has been fantastic because against Houston, even against Memphis, they were losing Curry off the ball and he was getting wide open catch and shoots. I recall very, very few of those that he's had unless it was off just a total scramble play in this series. I think one thing, you know, certainly David Blatt and his staff deserve credit for the level of cohesiveness they've been able to have in these playoffs. I posited against the Bulls and, you know, the Hawks, and then in this series that Cleveland wouldn't have good enough communication, that they struggled with that throughout the year, and I was dead, dead wrong about that. They've been fantastic. They've been avoiding mistakes so much. The other thing that I think is big, and I also think that the week worth of practice time leading up to this was huge, is basically with Clay and with Steph, the guys guarding them have basically had zero help responsibilities. Like, they're basically playing 3-on-3. If you go back and watch that Curry split of the pick and roll, and then when he tied the game with the layup in the end of regulation, you watch how Dellavedova is guarding Klay Thompson in the near side corner. He is not even moving. Like, at the very least, you'll see guys take, like, a step or two in just to sort of pretend like they might help because they know they can get back. Dellavedova is, like, locked up with Klay Thompson in the corner, and that's how they have been playing them a lot of the time. And they've been sticking to that, and they haven't had any mistakes. And I think that the practice time to just go over that and over that and over that over the course of a week may have been really helpful for them.
Yeah, that was actually something I thought about more during Game 2 than Game 1. I don't know if it was being there or whatever it was that the timing, I think, gave the Cavs the ability to really do a game plan and then practice it. And something that is a challenge in basketball in the regular season is they have so many games and they have so few practices, but to really get that time, and obviously things changed with Kyrie getting hurt, but they have done an excellent job of conceiving what they wanted the Warriors to do on offense. And I've talked about, I wrote a piece for Warriors World at the beginning of this series talking about how, to me, basketball is about choices, and what they've done is they've forced the Warriors into things that they don't normally do and that are not their biggest strengths, and they deserve a ton of credit for that.
What are some adjustments that you see? Well, actually, no. Why don't we do it this way first? We'll save those for a second. Let's go through a little bit and just talk about some of the individual performers in this game. Do you agree with me that Festus Azili, after a pretty good game one, was terrible in this game?
Yeah. I mean, his help defense...
His pick and roll D was miserable,
his
right?
His pick and roll D was there and was flawed, and his help defense was about it. It felt like it was a beat late, and a beat late against the Cavs is pretty devastating.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, I think that LeBron was really, when he came in at the end of the first quarter, I think was right about the time they had that 20-12 lead, and the Cavs got right back into it. Granted, the Warriors stopped scoring. I mean, that was ultimately the offense is ultimately it. But Azili really was not able to help James at all. I think James also got off again on Barnes. I would very seriously consider starting Iguodala rather than Barnes. Or at the very least, you could take Barnes out maybe very early on after about three and a half minutes, with the idea that you're going to bring him back earlier as the foreman, but give Iguodala more time. Because the other problem is, if you wait until there's 6-5 minutes left to bring in Iguodala, then he's got to play all 18 minutes. Or you have to take him out again, and then you lose more time of him on LeBron, and he's done a wonderful job on him. So I think that you really got to try and maximize that time for Andre on LeBron.
Especially when Harrison's not really scoring, when he's, I mean, some of that is just, you know, that it hasn't happened. He's gotten some looks, but if you're not looking for that surplus offense, I think that Iguodala, I agree with you. I would actually do what you said. This is the second suggestion, which is make him an early set, 3-4 minutes, somewhere in that range. And then he's a little bit fresher. And also, I think that opens up the sub pattern a little bit more for if you wanted to go to Draymond at center a little bit earlier, which is something I support broadly, especially if it gets Mozgov off the floor.
Yeah, and I think that was one of the big things for Blatt. I think that's been talked about ad nauseum now, that he should have at least tried Mozgov again the way he was playing against guarding Iguodala and see how that went. But, you know, he got away with it ultimately, and nobody would be saying how desperately they needed Mozgov back on the floor if they had just ended up winning by 10 the way they were set to do with 3 minutes left. So that was anyone else? Oh, you know, I will also say this. I think that as good as Mozgov played, and as awesome as Tristan Thompson was on the boards, I think he needs to do a better job offensively. Like, I don't think he's made one field goal in the series of the first possession of game one, and he's now a 1-for-9, I think, in the series, and he never shoots outside of 2 feet. So some of those are taps, you know, like those are tough when you get those and they count against your field goal percentage. But he, with the way LeBron is driving in, Thompson needs to do a little better job of finding the gaps in the defense for dump-offs. He has been hitting the offensive glass, and that's been effective. But one of the consequences of that is when the drive begins, he's already begun getting offensive rebound position. And when you do that, it's pretty much impossible to get a passing angle for a dump off. So you've got LeBron having to throw it up against the help. Thompson has a good chance with the offensive rebound, but maybe he could vary that up a little bit and try and find some places to get some alley-oops, get some dump-offs, because he just has not been scoring well enough so far for Cleveland. I mean, I think ultimately, do you agree with me that if Cleveland keeps scoring like this, they're not going to win the series?
Yeah, completely. I mean, you can't, it's not sustainable.
I mean, and I certainly think that the Warriors have much better process offensively. I think that they, with these lineups, they have more offensive talent. They just, for them, it's just a case of hitting the shots that they normally get. I mean, I don't think you can make Cleveland shot 32%, but I don't know that you can really make the argument that guys were missing shots that they should have been making. Maybe Dellavedova makes a couple more threes. Shumpert was only 1 out of 5, but they're pretty well contested, most of these threes. So I think that, the Cavs need to get better shots if they're going to continue to play well in this series and keep it close. So I don't think that their defense, I mean, has been great, and I think Golden State's going to struggle to score, but I don't think it can be good enough to offset 32% shooting over the course of this series.
The only thing that I would add to that, and it's something you actually asked Coach Kerr about, is that in both games, Cleveland has shot an absolutely putrid percentage on second chance points. And I think that some of that is that some of them are a little bit longer offensive rebounds, so it's not, like a tip-in or something like that. But they were 3 of 17 in Game 2, and they were 1 of 11 in Game 1. And I think that getting that, getting 3 or 4 more of those to go in would be enough to make a meaningful difference.
Yeah. And another good stat that Seth Partnow just tweeted out. He likened what the Cavs are doing to a football team using the ground game to keep the other team's high-powered offense off the field. He reports that there was a 6-minute and 20-second gap approximately in time of possession between the Warriors and Cavs, with the Cavs having more of it, which obviously makes a ton of sense with the way they've been playing. So what do you think of that stat? Is that like really, really that troublesome for Golden State, or is it simply an artifact of the number of offensive rebounds that they were getting?
It's not a problem at all if the Warriors are making any of their shots. I don't think the Warriors, if their offense is clicking, their possessions are substantially longer, shorter than they were. It's just some of it is the offensive rebounds, so that's a problem. But Cleveland's going to, that's their strategy right now, is to take the air out of the ball. But the problem is that's still a dangerous strategy, because the Warriors are a really good team. It just happened that they had a horrendous shooting night. The Cavs played great defense. Of course, that deserves a ton of credit. I do think it's Cleveland's best way to win. I think the rest of the series is going to look like that. But that doesn't mean that it's, it's this silver bullet against the Warriors. It's just the best path for a talented, hardworking, flawed team.
Marcus Thompson also had a good stat, and that was that the Warriors have been much, much better on the road in these playoffs. They've been averaging 1 away to game, shooting 46%, and that, of course, includes a lot of threes, and a 110 offensive rating. All those are first, second, and first, respectively. And then at home, they've been pretty much an average type of playoff team. So, and ninth in offensive rating at 103.5, excuse me, at home. Some of that could be them figuring things out later in the series as well against some of these defenses like New Orleans and Houston and Memphis. That might be something to keep track of as well if they play a little better on the road.
Well, and they've had shaky game ones and games two and game twos in every series. I mean, game one, even against the Pelicans, they blew, an 18-point lead? They got down to 2 points.
And I was in the 20s, I think.
Even. Yeah, and then the Rockets series, they could have lost both those games. In Memphis, they did lose game two. So, I mean, this is not a team that has started series strong. I mean, gets into the whole idea that I quoted Tim Kawakami, that, the idea of them solving opponents we'll have to see if they can solve the Cavs, but they've started every series slower than they finished it.
Yeah, I mean, as someone who picked the Warriors and for this series to go 7 games, maybe I should be, a little bit less sanguine about the Warriors' prospects here. But I think that the fact that their defense has been so good has to give them their fans heart. But, winning in Cleveland is going to be very difficult. The Cavs only lost once there in the playoffs. And yeah, it's going to be real interesting to see what happens. I mean, the loss of Kyrie, everyone thought, oh, well, it's over now. You know, even I sort of did, but really they, you know, when you consider how much it helps their defense, you know, maybe he's not that big of a loss, especially in his like off again, on again type of state.
I'm still trying to figure out what the tenor of this series is going to be in terms of Cleveland. Like, you know, I think we know what the Cavs are going to do, just kind of overall philosophy, but will the Warriors be able to do what they've done in the whole playoffs and, you know, avoid some of the mistakes, incidentally, that they made at home?
So one last thing before we move on to some good questions that people submitted with the Dunked On hashtag. You guys can always do that. You know, especially I think that'll become more prevalent now as we don't have a game every day. So please definitely do that. But what adjustments do you see? Frankly, I don't really see that many for either team because this has kind of been a strategically pretty simple series.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be a ton of it. I mean, we've heard the Warriors say a lot, you know, we're going to play our game at various moments in the playoffs. I would like to see more Curry-Clay interaction, you know, in that direct sense, like maybe Clay setting some screens for Steph, and not in the, really in the back screen sense. I'm thinking more in the direct on-ball. I think it'd be a challenge for the way that Cleveland has been defending them, but I don't think it's like, oh, that's their new bread and butter.
Why do you think that would be a challenge for the way Cleveland's been defending them?
Because just the way that you have to stay on both of those guys because of how dangerous they are with a little bit of space.
And yeah, so they'll probably switch it, right?
Yeah.
Do you think that would give a big advantage once you get the switch?
I don't think it gives an advantage on the switch, but just in terms of it's a challenge of communication and it's a challenge of space and, you know, getting to the right spots and everything like that. So maybe that creates a seam that Steph can cut through or something like that. As I said, I don't think it's a silver bullet. I think it can work well. And it's not like, oh, it'll work so much better against Cleveland. I just think it's something they can and will try more.
Yeah, I think getting JR into some situations where he has to communicate, he's probably the weakest link in that sense. For me, I think one of the big ones would be get Draymond Green going and just tell him, shoot as many pick and pops as you can because he's going to be wide open. And, all right, you know what? What if he misses four in a row in the first quarter? Well, fine. You're no worse off than you were before because they're already not guarding him. So it's not like they're going to know, oh, he can't hit it now. We're not going to guard him because they're already not guarding him. So they can always go back to what they've been doing where they're getting him, you know, either on the short roll, as we talked about with Coach Eberhardt yesterday, or, you know, a quick slip of the screen. Or another thing that Coach talked about, too, is Green will slip the screen a lot and then go screen for Thompson because there's no help for that screen as Thompson comes off because Green's man is still on Curry. So those are all things that they can try more. I'd say just give Draymond Green some license to bomb away and maybe he can find his stroke. That's what I would like to see them do offensively. Defensively, I don't think there are a ton of adjustments for Golden State. For the Cavs, you know, I would like to see more pick and rolls with LeBron and the five man. Get LeBron at least, if you've got Bogut or Azeli in the game, at least you can get LeBron a pretty open jump shot, that he doesn't have to work as hard for rather than if you go to the ISOs with him. So that can kind of give him a break. It also puts him in the middle of the floor. It, opens up all the passes, lets him find guys a little bit more easily than if he's on that left side ISO. And the Warriors did a great job of forcing him baseline, as I advocated, especially with Green on the floor. That was great because he was able to get over there and meet James at the rim in spectacular fashion on a couple of plays. So that would be my adjustment for Cleveland on offense. And then defense, the only thing that really comes to mind for me is I would try to pair Shumpert's minutes almost exclusively with Thompson. Because Thompson beat up Dellavedova in the post, was able to just shoot right over him. And then JR lost him quite a few times, and he really got hot in the second quarter. That happened when Shumpert came out of the game, and Clay was able to abuse JR and come off of those screens from Bogut. So that would be my adjustment, is to just match Shumpert up with Clay. But it has not been a strategically complex series by any means, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think that all makes sense, especially Shumpert on clay. One question I had for you before we get into the user questions, and I know we had some listener questions, I know we had some good ones, is you watched the replay. I haven't seen it enough yet. On the last, after the Draymond block you just talked about, Andre Iguodala ended up with the ball, and he passed the ball, what ended up going to off the sideline. What, because we talked about it live, but what do you see on replay happened on that play in terms of Iguodala?
Yeah, I tweeted at the time that I thought he was trying to give the ball up because he was worried faster than he normally would because he's worried about getting fouled. We're sitting on that side of the court, but in the upper deck, so we couldn't really tell that he was kind of falling out of bounds a little bit. I mean, I do think he might have slightly hot potatoed it more than necessary, but I think it was just an attempt to save the ball, and it just went through Curry's legs. Like, just kind of an unlucky play rather than, necessarily a blameworthy play, but it was, usually you'll see guys be able to make a more effective save than what Iguodala did there, so maybe the free throw thing was in his mind slightly.
Yeah, I mean, I thought of at the time that you could call a timeout, but I'm not sure if that would have been possible given the situation.
Yeah, not if he's in the air like that. I mean, like, if you have both, the rule, they changed it, about 15 years ago, I think, that the rule used to be you could jump in the air as you're falling out of bounds and call timeout while you're in the air. Now the rule is you got to at least have a foot on the ground not be just like in the air falling out of bounds. So I think he had to jump for fear that he was going to land on the line, and I don't know that calling timeout would have necessarily been an option there.
Okay, you want to go on to questions?
Yes. Why don't we start with this? Well, actually, no, we'll save this one till the end. This is a good one. And just to tease it, it's, if the Cavs win this, is LeBron the greatest of all time? Yeah, we'll save that till the end. That'll be a good one. Here's a good start. This is from Andrew M. at Moles A&M. Would hacking Iguodala and Bogut's towards the end of the... Bogut's. He wrote Bogues. That's why I did that. Toward the end of the quarters be a viable strategy to get LeBron more rest and disrupt Golden State's flow? What do you think?
I think... You could use it in certain circumstances, and if the goal is to get Iguodala out of the game, then that's an interesting wrinkle as well, because that's something we've talked about, is that in many circumstances, Hakka is actually designed not to do anything but to try to get that guy out of the game. In terms of, like, actually, how it impacts the game, one interesting nuance to that is that, from what I can recall, Cleveland's transition offense hasn't been particularly good, and one of the big differences when you employ Hakka is that you're not getting transition looks, at least not that many of them. And so in that sense, it actually works better for them than it does for the Warriors, because the Warriors are so good in transition. And so I think you could pull it in certain circumstances, but I don't think that this is a series that warrants a heavy use of it at all.
Well, I think it's always a good option if they have, even like a 60% free throw shooter on the floor, to take that foul so you yourself can get the last shot if the shot clock is off.
Sure.
Although Bogut will not be on the floor usually the way the rotations are at the end of the first and third quarters, so that would take that away slightly. I do think that taking away the fast break for Cleveland is not the end of the world. They are not fast breaking at all unless they just have like a very, very easy play. LeBron will do it a little bit at the beginning of these games, but usually it kind of runs out of gas. One of the nice things that people haven't been talking about so much in the ISO ball is, for everyone other than LeBron, when you have a 7-man team, essentially, Mike Miller played like 6 minutes, it gives your guys a ton of rest offensively. The way the Warriors play, you got to run around the whole time. And so now, granted, it probably gives the Warriors guys a little bit of rest too, but they're a deeper team. It's not as much of an issue there. So with the Warriors trying to run you out of the gym, slowing the pace there and catching a blow pretty much on every offensive possession is also a worthwhile component of the strategy. All right, do you want me to pick another one here, or do you have one?
I have an interjection. We have to talk about the Spates missed dunk.
Okay, we just did.
Yep. But I mean, in the scope of a game that ended up going to overtime, obviously it probably shouldn't have gotten that close. But that was a crazy play that happened in this game.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be one thing if the game was just back and forth the whole time. When the Warriors came back from 11 down the way they did, I think that it's hard to point to that, because think the tenor of the game might have been totally different. Sure, you needed those 2 points. You needed those 2 points when Livingston didn't offensive goaltend that pretty awesome lefty tip dunk that he had, and it was called an offensive goaltend. So and offensive goaltend, by the way, is one of those things to me where it's like, if you're a referee, you need to be absolutely, absolutely 100% sure that the ball is in the cylinder if you're going to make that call, because it's someone making a really good play, and I think they should be rewarded for it unless it's absolutely a violation, which, frankly, we've talked about this before. I don't know that it even should be.
FIBA rule.
Yeah. So, all right.
You can pick a question if you have one you like.
Yeah, so this is from Julius Proudfather, FCN Quotes. And he said, did Tristan Thompson have a bad game too, or was it just me? We talked about that. You know, offensively, I think he needs to be better. But when you consider the 7 offensive rebounds, all the loose ball fouls and team offensive rebounds where he forced the Warriors to lose the ball out of bounds on rebounds, and then defensively, he was quite excellent as well overall. So, I don't think he had a bad game, despite the fact that he was kind of in the negative and there was some criticism for not playing Mozgov over him. I don't think that he had a bad game overall.
No, I don't think he had a bad game. I mean, he didn't have a dominant game in that sense, but I mean, he didn't have to. And I mean, it's hard to give him a ton of the credit for Draymond having his struggles, but I think you have to give him at least some of that.
All right, another question here. We had a couple on the involving Curry's man as the screener in pick and roll when the Cavs have the ball. This is from Mo, that boy Mo 90. Why don't Cavs involve Curry in pick and roll more when Iman isn't in the game? They seem to go away from it even after success. You know, Blatt alluded to that in the press conference, that they found something they liked. That was clearly it. I was shocked that they didn't go to that more in game one. But when you consider that just doing something over and over again, I think you just have to change things up more. You don't want to try and milk it too much. Maybe you do down the stretch. But I think the Warriors improved stopping that as time went on. And you also just... You don't want to say when Shumpert is in the game, Shumpert should be playing like 40 minutes. So that's not that large of a sample. Shumpert did hit one pick and pop shot in the overtime. That was a huge shot. I wasn't sure that he necessarily had the footwork to get that in his arsenal. But I think Curry is going to improve defending that. To me, it's all about the axis that you take to go back to your man. And if you can do that, and kind of bother LeBron enough that he can't shoot the jumper while the man guarding him goes under the screen, and then get back to the popper on the same axis between LeBron and the popper, then you can make that pass a little more difficult and, try to kind of disrupt that play, because simply just getting there and bothering the shot slightly, Shumpert, Dellavedova, the guys setting those screens, those are not guys you want shooting contested shots. So just that split second can make all the difference defending it.
Yeah, and something you brought up earlier is that I'd rather see the center involved more in pick and rolls when Mozgov's on the floor. They're not mutually exclusive, of course, but I think that is an area that they can do more damage in and also create more looks for LeBron. But yeah, they can do both. I mean, I'm generally an advocate for more motion and more activity in their offense just broadly, because that's what I like in an offense.
All right, not final specific. This is from Josh Lee at Shinobi_Trader. Not final specific, but wondering what you think of heat check 3-point shots in general. This one was actually kind of near and dear to my heart, because I generally hate the idea of a heat check. And the reason is that the way that you got, I mean, we can argue about whether the hot hand exists or not. You know, there's been papers to and fro on that issue at Sloan and various other good studies. People have put in some work on this. And the idea of the hot hand basically is that, you know, because you have made a bunch of other shots, now you're more likely to hit your next one. So what do you think? I mean, do you like those kind of shots, Danny, or do you think that they are not so good?
To me, bad shots are bad shots. You know, like if you can get a shot that's, you know, more on the fringes of what you do and you can do that. The ones I always think about are Clay's. This is
a man who had 37 points in one quarter. You know, without that mentality, that quarter never happens.
But there's a difference between that mentality and being like, okay, this is the first time in a possession that I'm remotely open, I'm going to shoot this, as opposed to I will shoot a shot this possession. And I think that's what some guys get into is, you know, the I can shoot anything. And I mean, obviously, it's a little bit different.
But that's what he did in that quarter. If you watch that quarter,
in that quarter,
he was shooting the ball every single time he got it.
Yeah, he was. But I mean, that's one quarter in one game of one season. I mean, he's a fabulous player, and he has the capability to do that. But I mean, I just feel like you need to go for more. I mean, if you're in that mold, then maybe. But I just don't love Hejcek just broadly.
It's tough to reconcile, and I am playing devil's advocate here. I think I'm more in agreement with you, but I mean, so he should not have done that. Like that quarter, if he follows what you're saying, that quarter never happens, right? So you're saying that he should not have taken those shots that led to that 37-point quarter.
I'm saying that in the broad scope of it, it would not be good on the aggregate. But you know, if you're in that, I'm not somebody who can speak with enough definitiveness to tell somebody who is far better at this specific thing and who knows themselves, like, hey, you shouldn't take that shot. I mean, if I don't think they should, but at certain points it does work. It's just like any other thing that if you try it enough times, it'll happen.
Well, to me, my thinking on this is it's just fine against the Kings in January. Like, you know, they were up by like 15 by the time you really, really started going. You're at home. You're the Warriors against the Kings. Yeah, go ahead and let it rip. It was awesome. In the playoffs, I don't know that I really like that philosophy. And the way I think about it is, okay, you're hot, right? You just made a few shots in a row. Well, how did you do that? You did it by taking good shots, probably, right? You got open. You maybe got a great screen. You got going because you took a couple of good shots. Maybe you got to the basket. Maybe you had a particularly juicy matchup that enabled you to get good shots that were more makeable, and that's why you're hot now, because you made those shots. So rather than now, because you made some good shots, taking bad shots, yeah, let's milk this for sure, right? Let's go to this guy. But the reason that he's being successful is because he's able to get good shots. And by saying, oh, I'm going to take a heat check now, you're basically giving up the advantage that enabled you to get hot in the first place. So you're hot because you have an advantage. Milk it. Don't just sell for some crap.
Thank you for playing devil's advocate and then making my argument better than I made it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, too, that what I'll try and tell guys a lot of times, because, you know, we've all played pickup with that guy who just, you know, is shooting a bit too much, or even a guy who's a really good guy who starts taking bad shots. And, you know, usually this is patently unsuccessful. But the way I think about it is I tell people, look, you know, you're going to take some contested jumper, some contested long two. You're too good to take that shot is the way I think about it, right? Like, you take that shot because you're not good at getting an open shot. Being a great scorer is about the ability to get great shots most of the time, much more than hitting bad ones, because nobody can hit bad shots more than about 40% of the time. Now, that's definitely a skill to be able to hit those, and sometimes you need to take those shots. But if you're really going to be a great scorer, an efficient scorer that a great offense is based on, you have to be able to get and make good shots, and that's what great offense is all about, not making bad shots.
I think we're on the same page. One question. I don't want to get into the specifics of it, but I think that the conceptual question is interesting, which was from Jaden. Jaden_Barton was, what would you pay Dellavedova in upcoming free agency? And I'm going to take that into, it's not, you know, a specific number, but his role in, can, you know, how does he convey that to other teams into the Cavs?
Yeah, so what are you saying? Can you elaborate on your question a little bit? I mean, just to say how much we pay him, but remember he's a restricted free agent, right? So I mean, I think you pay him up to, you know, the only other way they're going to be able to add to the team, basically, most likely, since they're going to be over the tax, is by the $3.4 million mini mid-level exception. And he at least is someone who is already on the team and you can pay. Now, you're going to have to pay a ton of tax, but you know, your options to add to the team are limited. You can, they'll have early bird rights on him. So I think that they, you know, I would pay him maybe $3 million a year or so based on how he's played. But you got to remember too, he is pretty worthless offensively other than throwing alley-oops and, you know, making open three-pointers. But you know, the Cavs defense has been much, much better with him on the floor. So I think he is, you know, a valuable, backup point guard. He's shown that in these playoffs.
Yeah, I mean,
and that kind of guy makes $2-3 million a year, something like that. I think, you know, if he gets more than that in restricted free agency, you say, all right, I'm gonna let you go, you know, we can do better than you with our $3 million using the mini mid-level exception and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they would rather not have to use that on a backup point guard, but if the choice is that or overpaying Dellavedova, you do it. The challenge with him is that when you think about the typical archetype of a point guard is somebody who can run your offense. Like, that's the main thing that they should be able to do, and Dellavedova at this point in his career cannot do that. He does other things well, but it's I call it the Kent Bazemore problem, because that was what happened to the Warriors last year, is that they thought Kent Bazemore could be their backup point guard, and he cannot run an offense. And so it is a benefit when you're playing with LeBron James and Kyrie Irving that you can he's a luxury in that sense, but he is a very useful player, and the fact that you can scale up his minutes, especially with this particular roster, means the only reason I might slide a little bit above that number for you is just if the structure of the salary cap, that if it's over a couple of years, that contract's going to look fine. You know, let's say it's a 3-year deal. That contract's going to look fine in the third year. So maybe you suck it up for next year, especially if something happens with Kevin Love, and then you need all the talent you can get. And so maybe you push it up a little bit, but you're still getting on shaky ground to give a guy like him more, even close to the full mid-level.
Yeah, no, and I think they can do better than him, you know, for even $3 million a year, especially if it's a guy who wants to come to Cleveland. They're going to need a good backup point guard next year because Kyrie, I'm sure, especially when you consider the reports that his dad was really upset about the way the minutes were managed, you know, rightfully or wrongfully. You know, he's going to be coming off a fractured kneecap. They're probably going to try and keep him down to about 30 minutes a game next year. So they're going to need a real backup point guard. You know, I mean, and let's not go crazy on Delly. The guy had an 8.5 PR and a 4.93 true shooting percentage this year. And that's only on he's shooting very poorly, and he only had a 12% usage rate. And even in that last game, he was 3 out of 10, and he had 6 turnovers and 1 assist. So, you know, his defense was good. He was gritty. He got some key loose balls there, but, you know, they shot 32% from the field for a reason, and he was a big part of that reason.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a fair way to summarize his impact so far.
All right, so let's get back to that one. And this is going to be a very short answer. If LeBron wins the series, he's the greatest of all time. No, I don't think so. Although I will say that, and this can be a whole show if they do actually win it. You know, maybe if he is unbelievable in the series, it might impact my opinion a little bit. But and they win, which, you know, and that's probably what would have to happen for them to win. But I do think that if you just dropped prime Michael Jordan into like 2009 or 2010 and put him in the league next to LeBron, I think LeBron would be a better player in the 2010 league than Michael Jordan was, just because LeBron is more athletic. He's, you know, better passer, does more in the floor game, and was more efficient even than Jordan was. But, you know, I think when you look, when you're comparing eras, you have to look at what a guy did relative to his league, and Jordan is clearly without peer, and, you know, maybe Jordan would have been a better player, would have shot threes more, would have been more efficient with the new rules, you know, might have been able to do a little better with the hand-checking rules, although I think the zone defense largely cancels that out. So you don't know that for sure, but Jordan was unbelievable and would still be very, very successful today, an all-time great player even today. But, you know, humanity gets better at things generally, and you know, I think the best player, you know, I think LeBron is the second best of all time, in my opinion now. The best player in 2010, which is LeBron's prime, 2009, is better than the best player was in 1989.
I really wanted to troll you and say yes, but no. I mean, it really is.
I'm still sticking with Jordan, but it's a different way to look at it.
Just yeah, it is. I mean, I think that there's definitely something there. And the other thing that I like to think about with that is also, you know, how guys like Jordan and Magic would have done with the preparation techniques we have, not only physical but mental. I mean, the fact that how much video and stats and all that is available, I think that would totally change the way that those kinds of guys prepared for opponents and everything. I think it'd be amazing to see what they would do now.
Yeah. All right, so that's really, I mean, the breakdown of those two would be an awesome summer podcast for sure. That's one we can definitely get to. Maybe I'll go back and watch some Jordan film, or we can save that for the inevitable lockout in 2017. Just kidding, guys. Not inevitable, but
possible. You made my heart sad, Nate.
One other thing we do have to clear up. Coach was unfortunately incorrect when he said that he thought Deli played rugby. From Travis N. Reed, a loyal Twitter follower of the pod. He can confirm, he says on Twitter just now, Deli did not, all capitals, play rugby. Victoria is Aussie rules territory. That was a loose ball get, he says. I have no idea what that means, but I trust you, Travis. you've got your child in the photo, so that means you're trustworthy.
Okay.
All right, on that note, you, I'm sure, are quite punchy by this point. So am I. It's pretty late even here on the West Coast. Thanks to Danny for coming on again, despite the hellish travel day. He's going to be in Cleveland tomorrow night. I'm probably going to have a guest on tomorrow, and then we'll hear from Danny then again the next day, similar to what we did these last couple days with Coach and Danny. So thanks again for coming on. I will stop rambling now. You can follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Danny is Danny LaRoux, LeRoux. Go on to the Real GM page and find us. There is a link to subscribe on iTunes or XML through your favorite podcast player. Just paste that into the subscribe link, or you can just search for Dunked On, and if you use Dogcatcher or Beyond Pod or something like that. All right. Till next time, we'll have a game to talk about, and I'm looking forward to discussing with y'all. Talk to you then.